broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, and KBDH, San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf.
If you love great books about movies, there is a new indispensable volume that you'll enjoy. It's called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood by Mark Harris, who's my guest tonight. In this book, Mark Harris tells the story of the five films that were nominated for Best Picture Oscar of 1967. Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, and Dr. Doolittle. Along the way, we meet the creators of these works, see the fall of the 30-year-old Hollywood production code, and witness the birth of a new golden age of Hollywood films. Mark Harris, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much.
In the opening of your book, you describe a Hollywood that is sinking beneath the weight of its conservatism, creating overlong pictures that are largely sequels and remakes. The quote is, with aging stars and increasingly threadbare and recycled plots. It sounds remarkably like today's film industry.
It's a little like today's film industry, although the difference is that in the mid to late 60s, something really exciting and financially viable, which were these new movies like Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, came along to replace what was dying out. And right now, the movie business seems to be in a little bit more of a struggle for what the next thing is going to be that can come along that can really change everybody's way of doing things.
You know, not to rant, but today we see in some pictures like the new Indiana Jones movie, for instance, or Sex and the City, and I think when I'm watching it, why didn't they think to write this thing? You know, that would have been good. My cousin was telling me the other day that she had trouble explaining to her daughter, who was watching with her, what was going on in the Indiana Jones movie, and I said, I think Steven Spielberg would have trouble explaining what was going on.
Well, you know, the plots are never entirely the points of those movies. It's we're in an interesting place now because I think, you know, a lot of people rant about comic book movies, and certainly every other movie that is opening this summer seems to be a comic book movie, from Iron Man to The Incredible Hulk to Hancock, which is sort of not based on a comic book but couldn't exist without comic books, to the upcoming Batman movie. And I think one thing we've realized is that these movies can now attract great actors and some really interesting directors, and the very best comic book movies are really, really good. But we're getting to a place where you sort of begin to wonder if Hollywood knows how to do anything else and is interested in doing anything else, or whether these gigantic summer franchise movies are kind of the last thing that they know how to do really, really well.
It does seem like every movie has to be 2 hours and 25 minutes long, which in your book you talked about the roadshow pictures that had to be a certain length in order to have an intermission in them.
Right. This was a big attraction. Roadshow movies, which is now a term that not many people know, refers to this circuit of theaters, usually very big, like lots of seats per screen in many cities, where you'd buy an advance ticket, often for a much higher premium than the average price of a movie ticket, and you'd get a program book sometimes. There'd almost always be an intermission. There'd be an overture. There'd be exit music. It was sort of intended to make going to the movies seem like you were going to the theater. And a movie, of course, had to be a certain length to justify that intermission. So, you know, you see in the early and mid-60s just incredible, unself-conscious bloating of movies like Cleopatra and How the West Was Won and The Greatest Story Ever Told. They're just all much, much longer than they need to be. And it was partly because there was a kind of bigger is better aesthetic in Hollywood then as now, and partly because they needed that intermission.
And also they wanted to compete with television, I guess.
That's right. Hollywood was really almost paranoid about what television was going to do to its audience in the mid-50s and early 60s. And so they started relying very heavily on advertising movies as having certain things that television didn't have. Size, both in terms of length and in terms of the wide screen, length, and initially color. You know, these were all things that in the late 50s and early 60s you could supposedly get in the movies that you couldn't get at home. And then when network TV converted almost entirely to color in 1965 and 1966, this really hit the executive suites of the studios hard. They thought, you know, now what do we tell people to come for? You know, if TV's in color, what's our big advantage? And as a result, you know, as almost a direct result, the very last black and white movies that studios were ever going to make until they made them for sort of specific artistic reasons came out. After that, black and white was just verboten.
Yes, you had to really push to have a movie made in black and white now, I would think.
Right, and the funny thing is that what movies could offer that television couldn't in the mid-1960s turned out to be right around the corner, and that was adult themes, a way to approach violence, a way to approach sex that was at that time unimaginable for television. You know, people would have laughed if you had ever told them that there'd be something like HBO that would show uncut movies and even series with raw language or nude scenes or bloody violence. So, you know, from the late 60s on, for a very long time, that is what the movies were able to offer that TV couldn't, a level of adult content. And now that TV is doing that, Hollywood is faced with
the same,
you know,
dilemma.
Another really tough question.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to ask you about the violence and sex, because that's certainly a theme in your book, and we talked a minute ago about the production code, the demise of the production code, which was introduced in, I think, 1932 or 33.
Right.
And stayed until 1967, right?
It did. This is what governed the content of Hollywood movies for more than 30 years, and although a few things had been loosened up, the production code in the early 1960s was not all that different than it was when it was first written. There were rules about everything from the depiction of blood on screen to the notion that immoral behavior had to be punished to certain topics that for a long time in the production code you literally could not mention in a movie. Not only not depict, but something like abortion or prostitution could not, for decades, be referred to in using those specific words. That's why there are so many prostitutes in movies who are sort of dance hall hostesses or,
right,
or
right.
Saloon keepers. You know, these were all kind of professional euphemisms. And the tough thing about the production code was it was pass-fail. You either got the seal of approval or you didn't. And right around the time that I write about, they were revising the production code and revising it and, you know, trying to come up with a way that would allow American movies to compete a little bit on the turf that movies from France and Italy and Sweden by filmmakers like Bergman and Truffaut and Fellini and Antonioni, you know, to compete on their turf. But it was still a rule book. And just before the two most successful movies in my book, Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, came out, the production code was finally entirely abandoned. They just dropped it.
Just in the nick of time.
Eventually, it was replaced by the beginning of what we now know as the rating system, but Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate actually snuck through in a window that was after the production code but before the rating system.
The rating system, I think, is a problem now, especially with films that used to be rated X, like, for instance, Midnight Cowboy in 1971.
Right, 1969 was Midnight Cowboy. It was an X-rated movie that went all the way to the Best Picture Oscar.
Best Picture, and there was Last Tango in Paris. And the X meant that this was an adult film for adults.
Right.
Whereas today, X, of course, means it's a pornographic film.
Yeah.
So we now have the NC-17, but filmmakers don't want to get NC-17 because many newspapers will not advertise a film that's rated NC-17. So therefore, they cut their films to be rated R, which is essentially censorship. Yes,
right, and it's sort of self-imposed censorship. I mean, I think the problem with the X rating, whether you call it X or NC-17 or whatever, you know, set of letters they want to give it, is it's not consistent with the rest of the rating system, because every other rating, G, PG, PG-13, R, those ratings are all recommendations to parents. And that is really the only reason we have a rating system. You know, it's only to give guidance to parents about what they should know about a movie that their kids may or may not see.
But an NC-17 means they actually can't go in the
dark. Right. So suddenly, a system of guidance is replaced by a rule. And you can have an effective rating system that does one thing, or you can have a censorship system that does the other. But you can't have a system that accommodates both. You can't say, this is a guide to help parents, except for one class of movies where we're going to step in and act as parents and make the decision for people. And, you know, that's a decision with really huge consequences, even if you don't get into the double standards about sex and violence and all of the strange things that can make the difference between an R and an NC-17. This really is probably ultimately a decision that is best left to parents, not to theater owners or studios to decide for them.
But now that there is no production code and merely a rating system, everything, I mean, there's so much violence now in films, and the violence is so desensitizing, possibly, to young people, not to mention the rest of things.
It's funny because, you know, a lot of people in the mid-1960s opposed the creation of a rating system because they were sure it would lead to censorship. And in fact, a lot of the people who were advocating for a rating system hoped it would lead to censorship. They hoped it would create some really tough standards. But rating systems they never lead to censorship. They always take you in the other direction, because the minute you can give something a rating, you can show pretty much anything you want to in a movie as long as it can be rated. So suddenly there was a class for extreme violence or sexually explicit material. You know, it wasn't just banned as it would have been under the old production code. There was a particular rating that would suit that kind of movie, and that meant that you could really show anything.
It's interesting. If you look at the sequel to In the Heat of the Night, They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, the opening sequence is a woman's breasts, bare breasts, for about
yes.
4 minutes on screen.
Right. I mean, very raw scene. That movie is from 1970, and it would have been unimaginable in 1967 when In the Heat of the Night came out. And In the Heat of the Night actually also begins with the camera sort of spying on a nude woman with sort of the camera and one of the characters at the same time. But she's seen through a window, and the cross beam of the window is extremely carefully positioned. and you know, literally, the amount of flesh that could be shown in that scene was negotiated to the inch.
Really?
And then, you know, a couple of years later, that standard was completely abolished.
Yeah, then I guess you had to negotiate if you could have a window or not. No windows are allowed in this picture.
Exactly.
The book that we're talking about is called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood by Mark Harris. Let's talk about the movies. As I've been talking to my friends about this book and telling them how great it is and how they should read it, they all want to guess what the movies are. And they can all remember that Bonnie and Clyde, and they can remember The Graduate. And some of them remember Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and some of them remember Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and In the Heat of the Night, but no one in a million years remembers that Dr. Doolittle was, or how Dr. Doolittle got in there.
Right, Dr. Doolittle is the complete stumper, and it's really one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. One reason that I knew that using these five movies would make a good story is that Dr. Doolittle is really the other side of the story. I mean, we all know what incredibly innovative movies Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were, and they're still a pleasure to watch. And the two Sidney Poitier movies, In the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, allow me to tell a really, what I think is a fascinating story about race and where America was in terms of race and in terms of race in the movies in the mid-1960s. But Dr. Doolittle opens up a completely different story, which is this wasn't the revolution. This was the before the revolution, or the counter-revolution even. This was exactly the kind of big, bloated, expensive, overlong, bad movie that Hollywood kind of specialized in the early and mid 60s, and unfortunately, it's also the movie that really bears the most relation to the way movies are made today. It was literally greenlit before there was a script. They chose a release date that they needed a big family musical for. They just kept throwing more and more money after it. They thought they could fix everything with a kind of aggressive marketing campaign. The movie cost well more than the other four movies in the book combined. I think in contemporary dollars, it cost close to $200 million to make. You know, the only thing that's different about 1967 and today is that today it wouldn't get a Best Picture nomination. There has been enough reform in the Academy so that you couldn't aggressively push through a movie by getting, you know, all of your studio employees to vote for it for Best Picture, and by, you know, doing steak and champagne dinners for the Academy voters if they came to a screening.
Enough champagne and Dr. Dolittle looks good, I guess.
Exactly. I think they were definitely fed before the movie. So either they enjoyed it because they were drunk, or they passed out and had a good long nap.
Well, it is a terrible movie. I mean, you know, even if you like those kinds of musicals, it's a terrible movie.
It's pretty bad. I mean, the story of how it got made, I think, is really pretty funny, because it's one of those everything that can go wrong stories. You know, literally everything from they trained 1,500 animals and shipped them from California to London, and then realized that all the animals would be in quarantine for 6 months, and they had to train 1,500 new animals. To the sort of epic misbehavior of Rex Harrison, who really was kind of by then a monster to work with, but who you have to give credit for being the only person who seemed to realize that the script really wasn't in shootable shape.
Well, I like how Rex Harrison tells the writer, I don't want this character to be anything like Henry Higgins from My Fair Lady, whatever, it has to be completely different. And then he said, well, listen, it has to be more like Henry Higgins.
Well, it's a hard thing when you achieve your first really immense movie success when you are in your mid-50s, which I think Harrison was by the time he made My Fair Lady. And he, you know, you would think, well, he made My Fair Lady, it was a tremendous hit, he won the Academy Award for Best Actor, he should have been happy. But really, My Fair Lady in some ways was a humiliation for Rex Harrison. He was paid much, much less than Audrey Hepburn. He had to sit by and wait, even though he created the role on Broadway. Warner Brothers did not particularly want to put him in the movie, and he had to sort of stand there while they offered it to Peter O'Toole, who was young enough to be his son, and then while they went after Cary Grant. So Harrison went in, you know, knowing that he was the third choice, and I don't think that vanity and insecurity and anger ever really left him.
Now, you're kind of hard on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in the book, I feel. I mean, you're not a fan of the film?
You know, it's I've read now a couple of times that I'm not a fan of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I have very mixed feelings about it. I think it's a movie that stands beautifully on the strength of its performances. I think it's really hard, even now, not to watch the movie and not appreciate what Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy are doing, and also what Sidney Poitier is doing. I think he's a much more subtle and funny comic actor than he's often given credit for being. And in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, he really is the straight man. The movie is really about... It's a comedy, basically, about Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn's discomfort at the idea that they are not quite as liberal as they thought they were when their daughter comes home and says, I want to marry Sidney Poitier. If I'm hard on the movie, it's because I think Stanley Kramer, in some ways, the producer, director of it, did not see it for what it was. I think he thought he was making a real barn-burning, revolutionary message picture. And he was taken by surprise, by unhappy surprise, when the movie came out, that even though it was a big hit, a lot of people felt he was sort of making a point that interracial marriage is okay, that the vast majority of Americans were already comfortable with. I mean, he was mocked on college campuses for being too timid even to show a real sustained kiss in the movie, and he was also criticized, and I think this criticism was fair, for making the Sidney Poitier character almost a saint. I mean, you know, a virtual Nobel laureate physician. A lot of people said, you know, what kind of point are you making if you're saying that the only marriage that would be acceptable is a marriage to the perfect black man? Why couldn't she have just brought home any African American and have had that be okay too?
I guess you know, I mean, for one thing, there's a very comic moment when he learns that the guy is like a Nobel Prize winner. When Spencer Tracy learns it on the telephone.
Absolutely, and I think the more you watch the movie as a comedy, and which it really is intended to be, and the less you watch it as a message movie, which is what at moments it tries to become, the more you can still appreciate it. I mean, it's still a movie that a lot of people really, really like, but I don't think in terms of its thinking about where America was in terms of race relations in 1967, it was as sharp or as on point as In the Heat of the Night was that year.
When I saw it in the theater when it opened, the line, Catherine Houghton comes in and says, "Guess who's coming to dinner now?" to the maid, Tilly.
Right.
And she says, "The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King." It was a huge laugh. It was such a good, gigantic laugh in the theater.
Yeah, and in fact, that was a line that they had to cut after Martin Luther King's assassination. He was assassinated just about 3 days before the Academy Awards in April of 1968, when Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was playing all across the country, and Columbia Pictures, which made the movie, immediately pulled all of the prints and cut out that line, and then eventually returned them to theaters. I mean, they were terribly afraid that would sound like a glib or unfeeling reference, whereas in fact, you know, whatever one can criticize Stanley Kramer for, his heart and his politics were really largely in the right place.
It's you point out accurately that the film is shot in a very antiquated way by 1967 standards, and that the camera hardly moves, that the sets are very colorful, there's very little shadow.
There's a big painted backdrop of the Golden Gate Bridge, I think, or the
without any wind at all out there in the
right.
But what would you think if they remade Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with a Gay Couple today?
Well, you know, that's a very, very good question, and you know, my sad feeling is I don't think they would remake it with a gay couple, because I think that back in 1967, studios were, even though they were sometimes flat-footed about it, they were more politically progressive, they were more politically adventurous than they are today. I mean, you know, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was remade a couple of years ago as this movie called Guess Who with Bernie Mac, and the big idea behind it was, oh, in this case, it's going to be the African-American parents that are upset, not the white parents. Well, if they'd ever bothered to watch Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, they would have realized
that already.
Yeah, that's in the original movie. So the analogy would absolutely be a gay couple now, since in 1967, as the year began, interracial marriage was still outlawed in 17 states, although by the end of the year, the Supreme Court had ruled that you could not ban it, that it was unconstitutional to ban it. But I don't think a studio would do it now, because I think they'd say, oh, that's too political, it's too controversial, it's only going to appeal to a really small segment of the audience, and honestly, I think that's one change in the movie business for the worse, is that there are fewer studios that are really willing to take chances on material that even might be slightly controversial, and of course they never realize, they never think that people like controversy, that if there's a movie out there that people are arguing about or that someone's protesting, that's the best advertising you can possibly have.
You'd think they'd have figured that out by now.
Yeah, well, it's the more you spend, I guess, per movie, the more cautious you have to be. And I think the average studio movie now costs something like $60 to $65 million to produce, and another $30 or $40 million to market. All of the movies that I write about, except for Dr. Doolittle in this book, cost between $2 and $3 million to make. And you know, for that kind of money, you could afford to take a few more chances. In the Heat of the Night was greenlit because its budget was so low that Walter Mirisch, the producer, was able to make the case that United Artists could make its money back even if the movie never played in the South, which he really feared it would not.
Well, speaking of that film, the film that actually won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1967, the awards ceremony, as you mentioned, came just days after Martin Luther King's assassination. And my mother, I remember we were watching the awards together, my mother at the time said, if Martin Luther King hadn't been assassinated, it wouldn't have won.
Well, of course, all the votes were cast before Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Uh-huh.
So it was a surprise in many ways, because the movie that there wasn't as much in the way of Oscar handicapping in 1968 as there
was at my house.
I think people did it, but you know, of course, pre-internet, it wasn't this kind of semi-professional blood sport.
Yes.
According to most of the trade papers in Los Angeles, the movie that was favored to win was Bonnie and Clyde, which had hung in there after some really bad early reviews and kind of gotten a second and third and fourth life and really had become a phenomenon. And, you know, there was even then a feeling that Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were really in the vanguard of American movie making, that they were both in very different ways doing something that had not been seen before, whereas In the Heat of the Night was a little bit more earnest, a little bit, you know, more wrapped in a traditional form, which is a murder mystery. But I think, you know, because of Martin Luther King's assassination, when it did win, it had a kind of emotional resonance that it might not have otherwise. I mean, I watched the videotape of that ceremony, and you know, 40 years ago the Oscars were really a much shorter and more restrained affair than they are now. You didn't have applause for each nominee, you didn't have a lot of audience reaction shots, but
speeches were often thank you very much,
literally not longer than that. Just a quick bow and off the stage, and the applause was very restrained. There isn't cheering or yelling or catcalling. But when Rod Steiger won for Best Actor for In the Heat of the Night, you hear really some hollers and whooping, and it's the biggest applause of the night. And then the minute after he wins, Sidney Poitier, who was not nominated but was there to present Best Actress, came out on stage to present, and you hear the room explode. I mean, the applause is incredible, and I think probably to watch that on TV in 1968... you know, during a telecast where they had really kept their remarks about Dr. King to a minimum. The only person to talk about him was Gregory Peck, who was the president of the Academy. To see the reaction when Poitier took the stage, it was really electrifying.
Well, I think history has said that, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate were the great films of 1967. And In the Heat of the Night, it's two big emotional moments. I think if you showed it in a theater now, nobody would notice them.
Well, I know the one of them that you're talking about is the slap in the face,
right,
that comes late in the movie where a white racist who Poitier is questioning slaps him, and Poitier slaps him back without a second's hesitation, which was really a shock. I mean, some people called it the slap heard around the world. There were cheers when it happened. They had, you know, never seen anything like that in a movie. But of course, that is the fate of a movie that does something first sometimes, is that it In the Heat of the Night tapped into something that so many movies jumped on so immediately that, yes, now it wouldn't raise an eyebrow. But I have to say that of the five movies in the book, In the Heat of the Night is the one that the most readers have told me that they're pleasantly surprised by. That, you know, as you said, everyone has seen Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate. They know those are great movies. A lot of people haven't seen In the Heat of the Night and know it only from the TV series version that ran in the 80s with Carol O'Connor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think when they go back and revisit it now, there's a lot to admire in that movie. It's a really beautifully crafted, lean, stripped-down movie. Is it a masterpiece on the order of the other two movies? I don't know. It's a very effective movie.
Has some great acting, not just from Rod Steiger and Sidney Poitier, but Lee Grant and some of the
others. Yeah, a very, very good cast. I mean, a lot of the casting was done with New York actors. Steiger was considered a New York actor, and that's something that all of the movies that I write about, except for Dr. Doolittle and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the other three really have in common was they weren't made by Hollywood people. Mike Nichols, who directed The Graduate, and Arthur Penn, who directed Bonnie and Clyde, were both New York theater directors. Norman Jewison was Canadian. Arthur Penn had made some Hollywood movies, but was really kind of disillusioned by working for studios and had vowed never to do it again. So it was really a bunch of outsiders coming in and trying to do something different and kind of taking over the whole game without even realizing they were about to do that.
Well, the book is called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood by Mark Harris. We've just scratched the surface of not even that, but it's a great book. You guys should all read it. And Mark Harris, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. And until then, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.